An historic broadcast landmark occurred on this day in the year 1922. It was at about this time of day, an announcement on radio station WEAF in New York City. The introduction to that unprecedented broadcast rivals Orson Welles' War of the Worlds for most misleading pile of prose in the annals of radio. At 5:15 on the afternoon of Monday, August 28, 1922, a WEAF announcer said the following, read by our own Jonathan Kern.
This afternoon, the radio audience is to be addressed by Mr. Blackwell of the Queensboro Corporation, who, through arrangements made by the Griffin Radio Service, Incorporated, will say a few words concerning Nathaniel Hawthorne and the desirability of fostering the helpful community spirit and the healthful, unconfined home life that were Hawthorne ideals.
Now, for those unsuspecting souls tuned to WEAF who figured that they were in for a literary lecture, Mr. Blackwell's few words, which ran about 10 minutes, must have been surprising indeed. It was, he noted, 58 years since Nathaniel Hawthorne had passed away. And on that fragile hook, Mr. Blackwell hung the substance of his message. The Queensboro Corporation, developers of the young suburban community of Jackson Heights, Queens, was naming its latest group of high-grade dwellings Hawthorne Court.
Removed from the congested part of the city, right at the boundaries of God's great outdoors, within a few minutes by subway of the business section of Manhattan, this sort of residential environment strongly influenced Hawthorne, America's greatest writer of fiction. He analyzed with charming keenness the social spirit of those who had thus happily selected their homes, and he painted the people inhabiting those homes with good-natured relish.
That's not Mr. Blackwell. It's NPR's Art Silverman reading from his remarks, and that good-natured relish line might have amused Hester Prynne, who encountered the darker side of community in Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. The subway in question that took one to Hawthorne Court was the Flushing Line. It had just been built 5 years earlier, and in those days, the cornfields of Queens were becoming bedroom suburbs for the first time. The houses at Hawthorne Court were to consist of tenant-owned apartments with a common garden. Several minutes into his pitch, Mr. Blackwell summoned the imagination of, as he put it, the vast radio audience.
So that the present, jaded, congested section dweller, on looking out his windows, is not chilled with the brick-and-mortar vista, but gladdened and enthused by colors and scents that make life worth living once more.
It was a commercial. At the time, it was the commercial. People had sold a few things over the air, but here was a block of time purchased for $100 to flog real estate and the good life, oddly wrapped in the legacy of Nathaniel Hawthorne. Here are some facts about Mr. Blackwell's momentous radio pitch. His vast radio audience wasn't very vast by today's standards. Bill Jaker, author of Airwaves of New York, tells us that in 1922, the year of the pitch, the New York Times estimated there were 100,000 radio sets in New York City, none of them in cars, all of them tuned to one AM frequency, which was shared by 10 stations. Radio station WEAF became WNBC, and today it is called WFAN. Ken Schoen, who's the local sales manager of the station, told us that 10 minutes of airtime at 5:15 p.m., which isn't the way they sell time nowadays, would cost $20,000. The Flushing Line is still there. It's now known as the Number 7 train. In fact, it's the train whose clientele so appalled Braves relief pitcher John Rocker not too long ago. Hawthorne Court is still there. We're told by historians of Jackson Heights that the buildings are still considered very desirable places to live. And as for Nathaniel Hawthorne, Hawthorne scholar Marion Montgomery says using Hawthorne to sell a suburban lifestyle was ridiculous.
What Hawthorne was concerned for was a spiritual poverty that had already struck into the American nature.
But Queensboro did buy time for another ad. Commercials took off in the 1930s, and broadcasting advertising has been a fact of American life ever since.